In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about a part of the world that is remote and exotic that some people might think was quite far removed from international affairs on a day-to-day basis. However, as our guest this morning points out, it is also a part of the world that's considered to be in the sphere of influence of four nuclear armed powers, being China, India, Pakistan, and Russia. And the territory that we're talking about here includes Kashmir, Tibet, Afghanistan. Our guest for the program is Eric Margolies. He's a contributing foreign editor of the Toronto Sun newspapers. He's also a syndicated columnist whose articles have appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Los Angeles Times. He's the author of the book War at the Top of the World. The subtitle is The Struggle for Afghanistan, Kashmir, and Tibet. It's published by Routledge. And in the book, he makes the argument that indeed it is possible that this area might be the focus of the first major international conflict of the 21st century. And the idea of his book is to try to give you a little bit of background on this part of the world, look at some of the issues, particularly this larger issue of the struggle between, mostly between India and China, for the title of superpower in Asia. As we talk with Eric Margolies, you certainly should feel free to be a part of the conversation. You can call in, make comments, ask questions. All we ask is people are brief so that we can fit in as many different people as possible and move things along. The number, though, if you'd like to call, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So, again, 333-WILL. That's what you get. You match the numbers with the letters on the phone, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. And, of course, questions, comments at any point here are welcome. Mr. Margolies, hello.
Good afternoon.
Thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Delighted to be on with you.
We should, for people who are not familiar with this part of the world, I guess, we should talk a little bit about the lay of the land, so to speak.
Good idea.
And talk about exactly where it is that we're talking about and its geographic significance.
Very good. I'll do that. We'll paint a mental map, a word map for them.
Yes.
That's fine. And I'd appreciate it if you could also mention, I have a website.
Oh, certainly.
Which is, because I'm an internet columnist as well, and my site is www.foreigncorrespondent. That's one word. Foreigncorrespondent.com.
Okay.
And they get more info on me if they need it through that site or on the book.
Okay.
That's great.
Well, let's start, and as you suggest, and talk, and give people some idea of what is this area that we're talking about.
Okay, here we go. We are talking about an area that is really almost unknown to most North Americans. It is one of the most important and neglected parts of the world. We call it South Asia as a handy geographical term, and what this means is Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, Sri Lanka, and Bangladesh. This area now contains 20% of all of the people on Earth. It is the second largest English-speaking area in the world after North America. It will soon be the most populous. India's population in May just reached 1 billion people and will overtake China in about 10 years. So it's an area of vital concern to the world. And as I said, yeah, one about which we know very little.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the significance of this place really has to do with the fact that it is an area where the borders of several nations come together, China, India, Pakistan, and that it's also within the sphere of what used to be the Soviet Union, and the Russians consider it still to be their sphere of influence.
That's right, David. I call it in my book, In War at the Top of the World, I call it the leading area of geopolitical fragmentation. We have other areas in the world, for example, the Balkans recently, the Mideast more traditionally. But this area now is becoming a major conflict point because you have tremendous geopolitical pressures in the area. You have, for example, India is emerging as a major world power, and an aggressive one, too. It's asserting itself. It wants to be recognized and accepted as such. And its ambitions are bumping up against those of China, which sees itself as the master of Asia. They share a over 2,000-mile border, which is disputed, and over which they fought a war in 1962. And, in fact, the Indian foreign ministers are meeting just recently to continue discussing this issue, which is an explosive one. There is the Indian-Pakistani dispute, which is the most dangerous political dispute going on the face of the earth right now, with these two old foes who have fought three wars, who are locked in really what looks like a fight to the death over the divided mountain state of Kashmir. We'll come back to that. And then there's Afghanistan, which is where war has been raging for almost 30 years and has now become a geopolitical black hole in Central Asia and is sucking in intervention of Russia, Iran, the Central Asian powers, and Pakistan into what looks like almost a repeat of the Lebanese Civil War.
Hmm. Well, it seems that a significant potential flashpoint here is the Indian state of Jammu and Kashmir, known shorthand, generally referred to as Kashmir, which has been long an area of contention because it is portions of it are claimed by India, Pakistan, and China, and we have there a long independence movement going back to the time when India became independent of Britain, and some people thought at that time there were many Kashmiris that didn't want to be part of India, and there was a very confused bit of history there about just exactly how it is it ended up being part of India. But so there are people who, I assume that there are people who would want to continue to be part of India, there are people who want to be independent, there are people who would just as soon be allied with Pakistan, and it is an area that the Indians don't want to relinquish control over, and Pakistan continues to have strong interest in, and as you say, that it has been the subject of fighting, and fighting, very dangerous fighting when you consider what the consequences of escalation would be between Pakistan and India.
That's right. Kashmir is actually the world's oldest running international dispute, dating from 1947 when India and Pakistan were created out of British India. And the state was to have been held in this beautiful mountain state among its people to determine whether they wanted to accede to Pakistan or to India. The plebiscite was never held. Fighting broke out. India ended up in control of 2/3 of the state and Pakistan of 1/3. And ever since then, the two countries have fought three wars and argued bitterly over Kashmir. And now they are locked in a new confrontation, which is very important for us because it has gone now from being a regional dispute in South Asia, in other words, a distant dispute that no one cares about and doesn't affect us, to an issue that could very well provoke a nuclear war in South Asia. And in fact, we were probably within a few days of a nuclear war in May of last year. So this has become a vital concern to the whole world.
Hmm. That's something that certainly is very striking in your book, and not something that I saw any inkling of in all, you know, the various coverage of this most recent fight between the two countries. This is based on what you've been told by highly placed folks that was not for public attribution at the time, or it didn't really even get out at the time, that indeed they believe that the two countries were that close to not just going to war with one another, but to actually using nuclear weapons?
Well, I can't say for certain that they were going to use nuclear weapons because no one can at this point, but India and Pakistan in May of 1999 were within probably 3 days of a full-scale war along a 1,000-mile front. Now, these are major military powers. India has a 1.1 million man army. Pakistan has a 550,000 man army. And these forces were face to face, and the Indians were preparing a major offensive. It was only American pressure that probably stopped the war from happening. And the reason I say nuclear is because I know from intelligence sources in the area that both sides had primed their nuclear weapons. They were forward deployed. And India outnumbers Pakistan 7-1. And if the Indians really launched a full-scale attack, which the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency says they were going to, Pakistan would probably, very probably, would have had to resort to nuclear weapons within a day or two to prevent itself from being overrun and cut into the several pieces.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly, at the very least, it's a worry because we know that both states are nuclear capable.
Yes, that's right. As they showed when they both revealed their sort of covert nuclear arsenals, and in fact, what was so alarming about this was when it was done, India announced that it would use nuclear weapons against Pakistan if necessary, if Pakistan ever threatened India with nuclear weapons. And at the same time, the Indian defense minister announced that China was now India's principal enemy, those were his words, and that a lot of India's new defense spending, its new program on intermediate-range ballistic missiles and submarine-launched missiles, would be directed or aimed at strategic counterforce against China.
Let's in a moment here, let's talk about India and China, but just one more point involving the conflict in this region between Pakistan and India. It's also the case, and it may, again, this may be something that I'm not sure whether the coverage of the coup in Pakistan really makes this clear, but this was the this conflict and accelerated fighting in this area apparently was the precipitating event to the military takeover that led to the deposition of Nawaz Sharif and the installation of General Musharraf as the head of government in Pakistan.
You're absolutely right about that. Nawaz Sharif, who I'd interviewed a number of times in previous years, turned out to be a very deplorable leader for Pakistan, I must say, corrupt, incompetent, and was trying to set himself up as a civilian dictatorship. The army, and I say reluctantly, overthrew him when he tried to break apart the army. And it was due, in fact, to the Kargil operation. This was a secret operation launched by the Pakistani army, directed by General Aziz, who is now the chief of staff and an ally of General Musharraf, one of the three in the ruling triumvirate that runs Pakistan currently. And this attempt to seize ground in Indian-occupied Kashmir was aimed at internationalizing the issue of Kashmir and forcing the world to see what a dangerous and important issue it was. Nawaz was forced by the Clinton administration, who was publicly humiliated, forced to back down, and this led directly to his overthrow by the army. I was in Pakistan in March. I interviewed General Musharraf extensively, as well as General Aziz and General Mahmood, who's the director of the Pakistani intelligence. And from these interviews, I derive a story of exactly what happened with that. These three generals are determined, where Nawaz Sharif was not, to keep pressing forward with the Kashmir issue and not to take the pressure off the Indians.
Mm-hmm. It, as I recall and think back to the period before that round of fighting and before the military coup, and after, so we had the military, we had the test. India, Pakistan conducted their nuclear test. There was a great deal of concern about need to reduce tensions between the two countries. This was before the coup. It seemed that there was a point where the heads of state, Mr. Nawaz Sharif and the Indian
Vajpayee.
Mr. Vajpayee were actually talking to one another, and there were sort of suggestions that, well, you know, there might be a possibility that if those talks continued, that there could be lessening of tension between the two countries and improvement in the relationship. And then it wasn't, seemed to me, there wasn't very long after that. Suddenly we found that the two countries were at war again, and then it wasn't very much long after that that then we had the change of government. What was in fact there something positive going back at the time when Mr. Vajpayee, were talking?
They conducted their famous bus diplomacy, mm-hmm. where these two sister countries still would not have any kind of normal commercial relations or transport across their borders. Ridiculous. It shows how bad the situation is. They set up a bus link from Lahore to, I think it was Amritsar or somewhere in India. And the prime ministers went, and there was this outburst of feeling, as you mentioned, that there would be some sort of beginning of a thaw. But what was happening behind the scenes was that the United States was putting great pressure on Pakistan. Pakistan is bankrupt, and it survives only from aid from international donors, mainly the IMF, the World Bank, and the United States government. So the West the United States has a stranglehold over Pakistan in the sense that it controls its financial lifeblood. The U.S. was putting great pressure on Pakistan to come to an agreement with India that would resolve the Kashmir issue. And Nawaz was tending to go along with the American policy, create a thaw with India, and accept Indian control over two-thirds of Kashmir and make that the true international border. This is what India wanted to do, and India's voice was being heard by the Clinton administration because the United States was very anxious to do business in India, which is regarded as the newest Asian tiger. So there was a major tilt towards India. However, the Pakistani army, which is a major institution in the country, wanted nothing to do with this policy, thought Nawaz was selling out Pakistan's and Kashmir's interests, and staged the incursion into Kargil, perhaps without the knowledge of the prime minister. I really don't know whether he knew about it or not.
We're talking this morning with Eric Margulies. He is a contributing foreign editor of the Toronto Sun newspapers. He's also a syndicated columnist whose articles have appeared in many publications, including New York Times, Wall Street Journal, L.A. Times. He is a graduate of the Georgetown University Foreign Service School and New York University School of Business Administration. He's an expert in military affairs, South Asia, the Mideast, and militant Islamic nationalism. And the book that we're talking about here is titled War at the Top of the World: The Struggle for Afghanistan, Kashmir, and Tibet. And the publisher is Routledge. So it's in bookstores. It came out in March. And your questions, welcome. 333-WILL. Toll free 800-222-WILL. We should move on here, I guess, and talk a little bit about relationships between and or tensions between India and China. It seems to be the case that the government now, India's government that's run by the BJP, Hindu Nationalist Party, has taken as an important sort of talking point their desire and India's desire to be recognized as a major power, as a player on the world stage. And this perhaps gets us to this whole issue of competition between India and China for the dominant superpower in Asia. And there has been tension, border tensions also, between India and China before, so there is some precedent for tension between the two countries. What exactly is going on here between India and China? And in particular, has led now that the Indians, when they talk about their security concerns, to say that's their chief worry is China.
Yes, it is. India is, a billion people, as we said. It has a very large military establishment, and it is developing its own strike forces, nuclear and conventional, very rapidly. But India feels very nervous. Remarkably, Indian strategic experts keep feeling that they're being surrounded by China. On one side of India is utterly hostile Pakistan. On India's north is Tibet, which was occupied by China in 1950 and was the greatest strategic mistake that India under Nehru ever made, was allowing China to occupy the Tibetan Plateau, which is the source of most of India's rivers. And then to the east, India sees a fast-increasing Chinese influence in Burma, another very strategic and fragmented country. So the Indians feel that the Chinese are about to begin naval operations in the Indian Ocean, completing the so-called encirclement of India. And there's China's nuclear program, and of course China's vast military forces and population makes India nervous, and India feels that at some point it will have to confront China over either Pakistan, over Burma, over Tibet, or along the long Himalayan border.
Hmm. What is the state of relations between India and Russia?
India and Russia are quickly reviving the old strategic axis that they enjoyed during the Cold War. Russia has resumed its role as the primary arms supplier for India and is selling India arms at concessionary prices, as it did during the Soviet days. And the Russians and Indians regard each other as important strategic allies. First of all, India to counterbalance Pakistan, which used to be supported by the U.S. but no longer is, but also against China. Russia is very nervous about China, as nervous as India is, maybe even more nervous. And the two of them feel a sense of security vis-a-vis China. And also, each gives the other leverage in opposing what they call American imperialist designs in the region of the Indian Ocean and South Asia.
I know we're sort of skipping around here, but returning to China for a moment, just to sort of make everything much more complicated, it seems that the Chinese are facing something of the situation that the Soviets faced, where there still was a Soviet Union. That is, on their fringes, people who would just as soon be independent, particularly in the West, and certainly Tibet. The people of Tibet never accepted the takeover of their country by the Chinese. And in Western China, there are other indigenous people who are not ethnic Chinese who would just as soon be controlling their own destiny. What are the possibilities that sometime in the future that in Beijing they're going to really be dealing with some serious independence movements in the West?
Well, China is extremely sensitive on this issue. One-third of Chinese territory is non-Han Chinese, that is, in the major part of the ethnic Chinese population. That is Xinjiang and Tibet. In geography, it's huge, but they're sparsely populated. But Tibet has been in revolt against China, opposing China, as I've seen myself when I was there. Almost unknown in the West is the uprising by the Uyghurs. These are Muslim people of Xinjiang. And the whole region of Central Asia used to be called Eastern Turkestan. It was divided by Russia and China in the last century, the 20th and 19th centuries. China, these people want out of China. China has been waging a very ruthless war and executing them. And at the same time, China is practicing the policy of what I call ethnic inundation. It flooded Tibet with 2 million Chinese Han settlers, and it is flooding Xinjiang, as it did Manchuria and Inner Mongolia, with ethnic Chinese. So it's drowning all these ethnic minorities in the great sea of the Chinese people. And I think eventually Tibet will end up as a theme park for Western tourists, and that the Tibetan culture and the Uyghur culture and all the other peripheral cultures will vanish.
We haven't yet said anything about Afghanistan, a place that has been experiencing civil war ever since the Mujahideen there managed to drive the Russians out, and now the country is largely controlled by the Taliban, although there are places that their opponents, relatively small, I guess, areas of the country, their opponents managed to hold on to, so the Taliban doesn't have complete control. But it just seems as if it's a place that, after the Russians left and the war continued and the Taliban came to control a good part of the country, that the rest of the world seems simply to have closed the book on.
Well, you know, it's I spent a lot of time in Afghanistan. I was in the field with the Mujahideen when the whole world had forgotten or didn't care about this issue. And I saw with my own eyes one of the most remarkable military and political victories of the 20th century, which was the defeat of the Red Army, an event which began the unraveling of the Soviet Empire. And I'm interested now. I see the world complaining about the Taliban, who are a bunch of primitive mountaineers, complaining about how the Taliban are treating their women, as they've treated them always, in fact. But there were no protests from the world or on college campuses when the Soviets were slaughtering 1.5 million Afghans and sowing 100 million mines over the country and virtually destroyed the country. What we have is a wrecked country with a wrecked infrastructure and a population that has been so brutalized by over 20 years of war, nonstop war, that they don't know which way is up or down. It's a tragic situation. It's not getting better because foreign powers are meddling inside Afghanistan, as you mentioned, mainly the Russians now and Iran, and the Central Asian Marxist so-called independent states, and they're stirring the pot to keep the war going.
Mm-hmm. I'll introduce our guest here. We're a little bit past the midpoint. Eric Margulies is a contributing foreign editor of the Toronto Sun newspapers, has written articles for other papers as well, and is author of the book War at the Top of the World, The Struggle for Afghanistan, Kashmir, and Tibet. And questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, as we look at all of the tensions and strains here and the potential for conflict and how difficult all of these situations are, it looks as if the least difficult of all these difficult things might indeed be Kashmir, and that the most promising area here would be the relationship between Pakistan and India, as difficult as that is, and as it seems now, you know, as much animosity as there is between the two governments and between some Pakistani people and some Indian people, that if we had to pick one thing that we said, well, maybe we could start here, to me it seems that would be the place to start.
David, I'm not sure I agree with you on that. Mm-hmm. I'm discouraged about Kashmir. You have the military government in Pakistan are very militant on this issue. They're not Islamic fanatics. They are extreme Pakistani nationalists who want to fight India. They're going nose to nose with India because they believe that India eventually is going to break apart, like the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And if they keep up the pressure, Kashmir is going to be the beginning of the breakup of India. The Indian government, the Bharatiya Janata Party, the Hindu fundamentalist or nationalist party that runs India, and which, by the way, I was on my way to India in last March, and I was declared persona non grata by India just at the time that President Clinton was arriving in India. They declared me, I'm an American, as a journalist, they declared me persona non grata, obviously because of what they'd read in my book. They didn't like criticism that I'd made of India's deplorable human rights record in Kashmir. They are a very prickly and nationalist government, which is determined, whose policy is to crush Pakistan. And some of the more extreme elements in the BJP call for the restoration of the British Raj in India, which would mean reabsorption of Pakistan, Sri Lanka, and Bangladesh, and possibly Nepal, Bhutan, and Assam, Bhutan, into a greater India that would form the old Raj. So you have two very, very ardently nationalist forces, and I don't think most North Americans have any inkling of quite how fundamentalist some of the forces are that influence the current BJP government. Hmm.
Well, you talked about the fact that some people in Pakistan maybe think that Kashmir is the proverbial thin edge of the wedge, and if that can be broken off, then that would lead to a disintegration of India. It is indeed a about the fact that some people in Pakistan maybe think that Kashmir is the proverbial thin edge of the wedge, and if that can be broken off, then that would lead to a disintegration of India. It is indeed a large country, and the people in the various states, various places around India are, they have great differences, cultural differences, differences of language and music and food, and it's a very big and different place when you go one place to another. What is the potential for that kind of a fragmentation of India?
Well, I don't see it as a short-term possibility. India is a remarkably different country. It's a real crazy quilt of languages and religions and ethnic groups, and the people don't speak the same languages. But remarkably, India holds together, largely in part by inertia. But around the edges, India is definitely fraying. There's Kashmir. There's the long insurgency by Sikh nationalists in Punjab, which I've also covered, which was put down with great ferocity by the Indian government, and which is still simmering. And in the north, there's rebellion in Assam up on the Himalayan border, and in the eastern hill states of India, Christian tribes in Mizoram and areas around there, that's the area that abuts Burma, have been in revolt for 20, 30, 40 years. So the periphery is fraying in India, but the heartland of India still remains fairly solid. Having said that, however, I don't discount the possibility. Look how quickly the Soviet Union fell apart. There are not secessionist, but strong regional tendencies in India, as there are in China, and there's always the threat of national disillusion.
Mm. Well, I just ventured my guess that maybe there would be some possibility of a rapprochement between India and Pakistan, and you said you weren't certainly so optimistic. Perhaps then, do we think about what might happen to improve the relationship between India and China?
Well, the two nations have been talking for a long time and exchanging foreign ministers' visits, and I think they're trying to really patch over a basic disagreement or a strategic conflict between the two of them. This has not been resolved. They're two mighty elephants who are next to each other, and each makes the other one nervous. They have not defined a sphere of influence where each lets the other operate in a designated area. So they're nervously watching each other. And when the Indians announced, the Indian Defense Minister Fernandez announced that China was the principal enemy, and India began accelerating its program for intermediate-range ballistic missiles that could hit Beijing and Shanghai, Chinese took this as a message that India was adopting a confrontational policy and reacted accordingly by beefing up its defenses. In March, India announced it was increasing its defense spending by 27%, most of which would be aimed at China. So tensions are on the rise. Even though the diplomats keep talking, the military establishments are getting geared up for what they see as a possible eventual fight.
Hmm. Well, as I remember that those comments by Mr. Fernandez, that it seemed that at the time, some people suggested that he was something of a loose cannon and that might not have necessarily represented the viewpoint of the BJP or the government at large. Was that the case, that he truly was representing the viewpoint of the government?
David, let me insert parenthetically here that I've done a lot of radio interviews on my book, and yours is by far the best informed and most learned. It's a pleasure to be discussing this with you today. Fernandez is a loose cannon. He has a reputation for that in Indian politics, to be sure. But the fact that his statements were not disavowed, strongly disavowed by the rest of the government, indicates that there is a certain support for them. India's traditional ruling establishment, let's say the Congress Party, would never have said something like that. They take a much more cautious approach. They're not fire breathers. And they've always had an ambivalent feeling about China. But this is the BJP has this hardline element in it, which believes that it can increase the respect that India is shown by the world and India's status as a great power by ratcheting up the confrontation with China.
Returning for a moment to Tibet, as we know, it has been, particularly in recent years, the focus of some international concern, and people around the world and some Americans have lobbied in favor of Tibetan independence. And also, as you'd mentioned, the Chinese, their strategy has been to go into Tibet, and this has been going on for some time, to go into Tibet to do what they can to eradicate the indigenous Tibetan culture. They destroyed a lot of monasteries and historic places, and also then brought in ethnic Chinese, Han Chinese, and settled them in Tibet so that then the actual Tibetan people, the indigenous Tibetan people, would be outnumbered by Han Chinese in this effort to essentially to take over, to dilute the Tibetan people and their culture. Is this now, do you think, that there's any going back on this, that there is any hope that Tibet would be independent at some point in the future?
No, I see no hope at all. With one exception. In fact, you know, the first time I met the Dalai Lama, I discussed this exact question of the Indian-Chinese border and the possibility of a conflict between the two. In the event of a war between India and China, there is a chance that Tibet might break away from China, but then I suspect it would be quickly occupied by India. It is simply too strategic not to be allowed to be a vacuum or a buffer zone. Or if if China disintegrated, which is also a possibility, there is a chance that Tibet could be independent for a while. But any government in Beijing, any strong government, would immediately seek to reoccupy Tibet. Even Taiwan's policy is the same as Beijing's on the issue of Tibet. So China is never going to let Tibet go. And the West, you know, for all the huffing and puffing and rallies that we do, shows no sign and never has of really wanting to support the Tibetans. So I think Tibet will really exist as a nation in exile.
We have just about 10 minutes left. Our guest, Eric Margulies, he's contributing foreign editor of the Toronto Sun newspapers. He's the author of the book, War at the Top of the World, The Struggle for Afghanistan, Kashmir, and Tibet. And it's published by Routledge, came out in March. Questions are welcome, 333-WILL or 9455. Toll free, 800-222-WILL. Well, assuming that the rest of the world thinks that peace and stability in this region is important, not just for the people who live there, but for the world, are there some things that outside interests, friendly interests, can do to try to, as much as possible, maintain the peace and stability of this region?
The United States plays a role in the region. Certainly, it still has some control over Pakistan. It has a minimal influence over India. It can restrain Pakistan and maybe restrain India with financial threats from a war, but the U.S. is suffering diplomatic exhaustion caused by overreach and being involved in too many areas, and there's very little understanding of this region. That's one of the reasons I wrote my book, because it's such an important region. It could cause a nuclear war that would affect everybody around the globe, and so the U.S. has a limited role. Russia has some influence over India, but really this area is pretty much on its own. These countries do what they want. They operate from realpolitik and the idea that their own power is paramount. There's not much stopping these countries right now.
Well, the one thing that I suppose would incline them in the direction of peace is the desire for economic development. And certainly both China and India are thinking about this. Does that one lead to think more about peace and stability than war and conflict?
Well, yes. Of course, India and both China and India embarked on economic modernization and technological revolutions, etc. But I think a good analogy is France and Germany in the late 1800s were in a similar position and run by rational governments, and business was booming, and then somehow they stumbled into war. And I see, you know, Kashmir is the Alsace-Lorraine of the 21st century, to draw an analogy. Prosperity does not mean that wars are not possible. that's unfortunately the case. And there are, at the same time, I'd say there are still enormous strains in the region. India and Pakistan still remain extremely poor countries, with half the populations are illiterate and 40% living in the direst poverty. So you've got enormous social pressures in these countries which can explode at any time.
So just now for, you know, for someone who is just an observer of this region, other than being aware of where it is, what's at stake, something of the history there, what can one do other than sit back and watch?
One can, from the Western point of view, one can try and guide these, develop diplomatic solutions. Kashmir is the number one issue. Kashmir must be solved, and financial pressure and diplomatic pressure must be kept on Pakistan and India to come to a resolution of this. If not, we have to understand these are two countries who have now have nuclear-armed missiles that are on 3 minutes alert, and they have no command and control systems such as we do in the States. An accidental war could break out at any time, or an inadvertent war could break out, a nuclear war, that the RAND Corporation estimates would kill 100 million people and spread radioactive dust around the globe. I mean, this is why we're all affected by this. And the United States does have enough influence, or should focus its energies, particularly on India, in trying to resolve it, as it's doing in the Middle East with the Israel and the Palestinians, not very successfully, I might add, but there is some influence. Russia will not cooperate. It is happy to spend this, to play a spoiling game and to frustrate American designs in the region. China has another important role to play in keeping the peace.
It seems, you know, when one thinks back to, again, to the point where the nuclear tests, the two countries carried out the nuclear tests, and the United States made it clear that it was very concerned about this and the development of the two countries' nuclear problems, there were economic sanctions imposed. I think that it turned out, because as you say, because the economy of Pakistan is in such bad shape, that it may be a serious issue for them, but I think India just sort of shrugged it off and sort of said, "Well, that doesn't bother us." And it seems that in that case, that diplomatic or economic levers don't seem to get us very much.
Well, the sanctions were kind of laughable sanctions. They weren't very serious. They didn't hit India where it would have hurt, which is in its technological industry and its software. It's the world's second largest exporter of software now. They were token sanctions, and the important thing is behind the scenes, I suspect that the United States has encouraged India to a certain extent to develop its nuclear weapons as a counterbalance to China. India has received a great deal of nuclear technology and know-how from Israel. The United States certainly must know about this and has turned a blind eye to Israel's export of technology. In Washington, the pro-Israel lobby is now teamed up with India on a number of important issues, named at sort of keeping Pakistan under economic embargo. So there was really not much desire on the part of Washington to punish India or Pakistan, and of course the sanctions just sort of faded away.
What, just perhaps, we're coming down, we have a couple of minutes left. There, one country that we haven't spoken about, and I'm interested in what you might have to say about, is Burma, a country that's been under military rule for some time now. What is the possibility that there might be some change there?
I think change will eventually come, but Burma is a very complicated and mysterious country. There have been four or five wars going on there since 1945. The whole interior of Burma is run by these insurrectionist armies like the Shans and the Waz and the Mons. And the Burmese central government is spending all of its time and resources fighting the rebels in the north. It's a nasty military dictatorship. It was run by a very strange autocratic man named Ne Win, who apparently still controls things from behind the scenes. It's a repressive, nasty government, and Burma is a basket case, but it's a very rich country in minerals. and in wood, and it's very strategic. It sits on India's eastern flank, and it has very important water resources, and it's become a major client of the Chinese. And rebels, Burma seems to be supporting some of the rebellions in India's eastern hill states. So the Indians are watching Burma very nervously. We remember during World War II, Burma was known as the backdoor to India.
Mm-hmm. Just maybe one more thing about the long-term prospects for relationship between China and the United States.
Very interesting subject. My own view, having been a long-time China watcher on this subject, is that I still think that China and the United States have more interests in common than they do in opposition. And that China is not, as some American conservatives claim, an international threat. China's policy has always been that it's happy more or less within its borders, but it expects everybody within the immediate vicinity of its borders to kowtow to the emperor in Beijing. Well, sort of like the United States does with Central and Latin America. You know, you can be independent, but up to a point, but you still have to show obedience to the policy of the Chinese government. And this, I think, China is going to continue. I don't know what's going to happen with the Taiwan issue. I suspect that China will become less communist and Taiwan will one day merge with China. But this is as if all goes well and the Communist Party sort of slowly loses its power in Beijing or modifies into a less communist but still authoritarian government. This is what I see happening, a sort of a Singapore type rather than a Chinese communist. But you never know, because China remains a fragile country and could at some point revolution or convulsions in Beijing could result in anarchy within the country.
Well, there we must leave it because we've used our time. We want to say to you, Mr. Margulies, thanks very much for talking with us.
You're most welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Our guest, Eric Margulies, is contributing foreign editor of the Toronto Sun newspapers. And his book, if you would like to read it, is titled War at the Top of the World, The Struggle for Afghanistan, Kashmir, and Tibet.